Welcome to MS Minute with DC&D, your podcast for understanding multiple sclerosis. Every month, our MS experts tackle a different topic to help you manage your disease and live a better life. DC&D is a private neurology practice based out of Dayton, Ohio. It's certified by the National MS Society as a comprehensive MS care center. Please note this podcast and its content is designed for educational and informational purposes only.
Welcome to MS Minute with DC&D. I'm your host, Natalie Pugar. In this episode, we are discussing spasticity. According to the MS Society, more than 80% of patients living with MS have some form of spasticity, making it one of the most common symptoms. Joining me today is physical medicine and rehabilitation doctor Jim Beegan, who specializes in spasticity management. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, let's just dive into this and kind of help us explain what spasticity is.
Spasticity is a symptom usually of upper motor neuron disease. Upper motor neuron disease would imply any type of problem with the brain or spinal cord. So MS would certainly fall within the category of diseases where we'd expect to see spasticity. Spasticity is not a disease by itself, it's a symptom of other diseases. Okay, so in our focus today, multiple sclerosis. Spasticity is an elevation in muscle tone. So muscles are tighter, stiffer, and overactive compared to their normal baseline. So it's a condition where the muscles to the patient generally feel tighter, more painful, and more overactive. To the clinicians, the therapists, nurses, or doctors treating them would feel like the muscle tone is increased compared to normal.
Okay. So do we know what causes this?
The exact cause is still not really known. It's associated with brain and spinal cord injuries or diseases, but the exact mechanisms are not certain. In my mind, I have sort of a simplistic view of it, which is that the normal function of much of the brain is to inhibit or to decrease the firing of motor units that are already designed to fire at their baseline. So what I'm trying to say here is that in normal neurological function, in our muscle system, in our nerve system, there are subroutines. If you think about it like a computer, there are running subroutines that go all the time that encourage the muscles to fire. So anybody with children can see these subroutines very easily. If you stroke a baby's cheek, they'll turn their head to the side that was stroked automatically. It's not something they have control over. It's a complex motor response. Another one is the startle response. If you take a baby and, you know, drop it suddenly a few feet in your arms, the baby will be delighted and laughing, of course, but it'll also throw its arms up in the air and arch its back. And that's known as the Morrow or startle response. And those are inborn automatic motor program systems. They're in all normal people. But as we get older and we learn to control our movements, those subroutines become incorporated in larger movement patterns. But they're still there. They're just covered up. So if you were to stroke my cheek once, I might suddenly turn my head to the left, particularly if it was a surprise to me.
Right.
But if you kept doing that, I'd stop and I'd tell you to knock it off. Whereas a baby will always turn their head that way. They don't have control over it. They have not incorporated that movement. A better example is a startle response. You know, a loud noise in a daycare center with infants, all the kids throw their arms up in the air.
Yeah.
A loud noise suddenly, between the two of us, we might throw our arms up in the air the first time. But then after that, we would control it and tell whoever's making the noise to knock it off. You can see these motor patterns come out in sports and athletics, too. These are, you know, they're incorporated. They don't go away, but they're part of our system, okay? So the reason I'm going on and on about this is that when there's damage to the brain or spinal cord, those sort of inborn pre-programmed motor patterns become accentuated. They come out. So one manifestation of spasticity we commonly see is people have an exaggerated startle response. So a person with quadriplegia, say from a spinal cord injury, or in the case of MS, let's say they have damage to their cervical spinal cord from the multiple sclerosis, if they're downtown in their wheelchair and someone honks their horn, they might fly their arms up in the air, lose control of their wheelchair, and the, you know, the stuff on their wheelchair tray might spill on the sidewalk. That's a common complaint I get is, you know, I can't control my body jumping like that in response to loud noises. So it's an unmasking of a normal response. It's always there. That explains why some of these patterns are so common. You know, for example, many people will have muscle spasticity of their hand such that their hand is flexed into a fist. And that's because of a inborn motor pattern of finger flexion. Okay. And these patterns make sense evolutionarily, or if you think about what's functional for a baby primate, it's good to hold on to your mother with tight clenched fist. So that motor pattern is there from the very beginning. Okay, it's called the daddy response sometimes. You know, if you stroke a baby's hand, they'll automatically grab your finger.
Yes.
If a person with stroke or multiple sclerosis, if they have something in their hand, their fingers might automatically flex in the same way, whether they want to or not. And this can become very damaging over time because what's stimulating that motor response might be skin breakdown or pain or the fingers themselves curling into the hand. So you can see the problem. You're into a positive feedback loop at that point. You're into a vicious circle. Fingers are pushing into the palm, which causes pain. That stimulation makes a motor response for the fist to be tighter. The tightness of the fist makes more skin breakdown, more pain, more stimulation to the area, which makes the fingers flex more vigorously. And then before you know it, you can end up in a situation where someone loses function of their hand because of the muscle spasms.
Right. So is the different types of spasticity obviously very dependent on the person and individual?
The key to trying to help people with any manifestation of multiple sclerosis, but particularly in spasticity, is individual assessment, because it can affect people all different ways. There are typical stereotype patterns. It's very rare for people to come in with spasticity such that their fingers are hyperextended all the time. Mm-hmm. That's not unheard of, but very rare. More typically, if someone has muscle spasticity in their hand or arm, they're going to complain of their hand being in a fist or being difficult to open up or extend at the fingers. So recognizing those patterns helps us to kind of look for different problems, okay? But people do come across in all different ways with multiple sclerosis. You have to assess each individual. The other tricky thing about spasticity management is that the goal is not to destroy all spasticity. The goal is not rid the person of all the excess muscle tone, because sometimes the muscle spasticity can actually be helping the person.
Huh.
So if we go back to our simple example of someone who's got finger spasticity, finger flexion spasticity, their hand wants to go into a fist. If they have underlying weakness of the hand, which they almost always do if they have significant spasticity, they may be using the spasticity as a way to help compensate for the weakness. In other words, if someone uses a grab bar to get up out of a chair, if you destroy or get rid of all the spasticity or tightness in their finger flexors, they may lose that ability because now their hand is functionally weaker.
So you really have to know what you're doing when you're treating patients.
You have to consider the whole person and consider the different muscle groups, how bad the spasticity is, and what manifestations it's causing the person. Because it may not all be harmful.
Hmm.
But
patient history obviously is super important, and just talking to the patient about their daily routine.
That's the heart of it. You really have to get down to, you know, what are the patient's complaints, what's bothering them the most, and also what is their goals? Or, you know, the caregiver's goals are also important. If someone's severely disabled and needs help from other people, what are their goals? So, you know, for example, a child with, say, a bad finger flexion spasticity, where their hand is pulled into an uncontrolled fist position, the caregiver may be frustrated because it's difficult to dress the child, keep their hand clean. They may be worried about skin breakdown or foul odor from the hand constantly being clenched up and difficult to keep the hygiene good. The child may be more concerned about cosmetics, how it looks. They may be concerned about how it makes them feel different from other children. They may be having pain from that, and that may trouble them. You know, they may be worried about, you know, use of their hand, obviously. And then the doctor, you know, looking at that patient, we, you know, our main concern may be prevention of permanent joint scars or contractures. Our concern may be improving the function of the hand, preventing further skin breakdown, that sort of thing, preventing nerve damage, you know, like a peripheral nerve injury, say to the median nerve at the wrist. If someone's wrist is constantly pulled into flexion, that can damage the nerve and, you know, cause a bad carpal tunnel syndrome, for example. So each of the people, the patient's the center of it, but each of the people working with the patient has to consider, you know, what the patient's goals, caregiver goals, and then long-term medical goals. That's where the, you know, nurses, doctors, therapists come in and say, well, you know, have you considered in the long run, there may be a cure for what you have. There, you know, I think it's quite conceivable, you know, someday there'll be an actual cure for a lot of these conditions, including MS. It's important to me, even if a person's not using their hand in a functional way at all, you might say, well, why bother trying to keep the hand supple and loose when they're not using it at all? In my mind, prevention of permanent joint problems is a very good goal. Because if, you know, if we eventually can cure multiple sclerosis, but their hand is scarred down into a fist position, that hand is still not getting better, even if the MS is better.
Right. So what are some of those long-term effects, I guess, if nothing is done? You mentioned a couple.
Yeah, pain, joint contractures, peripheral nerve damage, skin breakdown can lead to infection, sepsis. I mean, people have, you know, gotten into big trouble with their limbs that way.
And when we talk about limbs, it's not just arms and hands, legs too. Is that pretty common?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, other sort of tertiary or, you know, more distant effects you might not think about are social isolation, embarrassment. I mean, you know, all of us, myself included, we all fear public humiliation. You know, the reason we hate public speaking is we're all, you know, scared of being embarrassed in public. And to deal with an arm or a leg that's flexed into an odd position, it immediately singles people out. And people are very conscious of that. And it's, you know, very disruptive to their social life and, you know, very frustrating. Many times, you know, most people are more ignorant than they are kind, or mean, I should say, and they don't really intend to be mean. But the way that comes across to a lot of my patients when they're out in public and they're partially paralyzed or have, you know, obvious tone patterns where their arms and legs are in unusual positions, many times people will assume they have cognitive impairments or that they're not as intelligent as they are.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of my patients will discuss frustration with people addressing their, you know, son or daughter, or addressing their husband or wife instead of them, assuming that, you know, just because their arm's in a funny position and looks paralyzed, that, you know, they themselves are, you know, cognitively impaired or something. So
that is really sad.
It's very aggravating for people. And, you know, that's one of those tertiary effects. You know, other effects are difficulties at work or in school. You know, I think about a couple of young patients I've had who had, you know, exaggerated startle reflex, where a loud noise would make them, you know, their body jump up or their arms fly up uncontrollably. And you might say, well, it's no big deal, is it? Well, it might be if you're a college student trying to get to class, you know, and you're in your power wheelchair, and every time someone honks their horn, all your books and stuff fall on the ground and you lose control of your wheelchair. It becomes a huge problem for you.
For sure. So let's talk about what can be done, you know, when you have a patient that comes in with some of these issues. And I guess before we dive into that, what do they usually present with? Do they come in, you know, having this extreme cases, or is it usually something more mild to begin with?
It varies greatly. So it can be anywhere from a completely dependent person who lives in a group home or is totally dependent on family for care, and the issue is skin breakdown, difficulty with hygiene, and difficulty dressing. So maybe their particular manifestation of the spasticity is their legs cross over uncontrollably or push together to knees hard. You know, that's very difficult for caregivers to deal with, obviously, for toileting, hygiene, bathing, dressing. So it can go all the way from that, where you're basically relying on the caregivers to tell you what's needed, all the way to, you know, a professional person who is troubled by their non-dominant arm being in a flexed and twisted position, and they're mostly concerned about, hey, when I give presentations to people, they're distracted by my arm. Can you help me get this thing down. So it can be very, you know, high level goals for a person who's independent, but, you know, partially disabled, all the way to people who are totally disabled, and more a matter of helping the caregivers and helping the person long term to prevent long term complications.
Gotcha.
So it varies wildly.
Okay, so what do you typically recommend for treatment? Is that all obviously based off of individual cases too?
Individual assessment is the cornerstone, the beginning of it. There's a few general principles though that I think are helpful for pretty much everybody. One is you want to keep in mind that exercise, including strength building, is very helpful. You know, range of motion exercises done correctly so as not to damage the joints twice a day for spastic muscle is helpful, not often curative, but helpful. Strength building of spastic muscles is also helpful. Sometimes people are concerned that if they make their tight muscles stronger, then that might make their muscle tightness worse. Because it's logical. You'd think, well, if the muscle's bigger and stronger, won't it be tighter? Won't
right.
it be more force exerted? But actually, in almost all cases, the opposite is true. A stronger muscle has more motor control. A part of strength is the brain's adaptation to controlling the muscle better. So building up strength, keeping up with regular exercise is actually very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
True for, you know, multiple sclerosis in general. You know, exercise, not to the point of total exhaustion, but exercise to the point of building up the muscles like an athlete, is almost always helpful.
Which is something that you probably don't want to do when you're having issues with your limbs, you know, especially legs, I'm guessing, you know.
Most people find it hard enough to keep up with regular exercise anyway, let alone
right.
if you're dealing with pain and limping or, you know, weakness and spasticity of a limb. So, yeah, it's true. That's where I think working with an individual trainer or physical therapist can be very helpful to kind of get an idea of the right kind of exercises and, you know, how to best compensate and work around, you know, the occupational therapist as well for upper limb function can be very helpful with that. You know, they often have some very clever ideas about how to, you know, keep up with a good home exercise program mm-hmm. long term. It's the long term exercise is very important in multiple sclerosis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we need to preserve muscle and joint function as much as possible, even if a person's severely disabled. Because if nothing else, we have to anticipate there'll be better treatments down the road.
True.
I want these patients to be ready to benefit maximally from whatever comes down the road,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the future, hopefully soon.
Right.
In terms of where to approach it from there, I always start with the patient and the caregiver goals. You know, what's most important to you? And you'll often be surprised. You know, sometimes you'll meet a patient and say, well, there's the obvious problem. But that may not be the main problem to them. You know, going back to my example of the college student, you know, whose main issue is startle response, you would treat that very differently than if his main complaint was he can't use his computer keyboard because his hand's too tight.
Uh-huh.
If someone has generalized elevations in muscle tones and hyper-responsiveness, the elevated startle response, or you know, they have a lot of tightness all through their body, including their trunk, their neck, both arms, both legs, then typically we'll start with medications. There are several out there that can be very helpful. We can go into the details as much as you want. The general rule with medications for spasticity is that they have to be used carefully. In general will start low and build up gradually because they all share some common side effects. Mm-hmm. Increased weakness, increased sedation, difficulty with cognition.
Increased weakness.
Correct. Yeah. A spastic muscle is almost always underneath the spasticity also weak. So if you give somebody a medicine to decrease muscle tightness, they almost always will unmask some weakness. Some people will, you know, this is not a majority, say 10 to 20% of patients who I give a muscle relaxant to will feel weaker and more tired in a general sense, like all over their body, even in muscles that aren't overly tight. So increased weakness, unfortunately, is a fairly common side effect. I always tell my patients with pretty much all these treatments, we're trying to find the sweet spot between controlling spasticity but not causing weakness.
Uh-huh.
Now, there's a balance there, unfortunately. none of the treatments for spasticity are curing the underlying condition. So we're trying to remove spasticity to allow the person to function better. That's very different than what we really need. What we really need is a cure for brain injury, spinal cord injury. We need cures for MS. We need cures for stroke. We don't have it yet. So we're trying to compensate. We're trying to find a balance between making people too weak and controlling their spasms and pain. So in regard to the medicines, there are several out there which are effective to a point, but they all share the potential side effects of increased weakness, tiredness, and sedation. So that's what we have to always watch for. In terms of other treatments beyond just medications, we look at focal treatments. What can be done if someone's chief complaint is one arm or both legs, say, in very specific muscle groups? In that case, we'll often fall back on injected medications, which can help. So the one most commonly used that way is Botox. There are three others, but these are all botulinum toxins. They're literally poisons that are purified and made safe for clinical use. And these are very nice because they will decrease spasticity in the majority of patients in the specific muscle groups you're injecting. So they're very helpful if someone has one region of their body or maybe two regions of their body that are tight, as opposed to a generalized problem. They don't work for everybody. I usually quote success rates of about 85%, but okay. You know, there's no such thing in legitimate medicine as a panacea that just works for everybody. Yeah. There's no such thing. There are potential side effects. They're temporary, but the side effects by temporary, I mean they last about 3 months. So increased weakness of the muscles we inject, increased weakness of other muscle groups around where the toxin might spread to, dry mouth, dry eyes, trouble swallowing.
Yeah.
Most common by far is increased weakness, obviously. It's kind of how the toxins work. Mm-hmm. They decrease spasticity by partially weakening the muscle. So we're back to that balance, trying to, find a sweet spot between decreasing tightness but not causing too much weakness. So those can be very helpful. They've been, they've been around for 20 plus years now. So we have a fairly good idea of how they work and where they should be deployed. So they're relatively safe. It's very, very rare to see serious complications from those. But, you can cause increased weakness. And when it happens, you just sort of have to apologize and say, well, sorry about that. It'll go away in 3 months.
Wait it out,
yeah. It can be a rough 3 months, obviously. Other treatments that can work for generalized tightness are very nice modality. Again, not a new treatment, but one that's used less, called intrathecal baclofen. This is a pump that's implanted under the skin that delivers a constant flow of medication to relieve muscle spasticity. And it delivers it right into the spinal cord.
Wow.
So nice thing about that, it's not going to cause sedation or tiredness or troubles with thinking. It typically works better for the lower body than the upper body. So, if someone's chief complaint is their hands are too tight, it would not be the right choice. But if someone's chief complaint is their entire body from the chest down through their legs is excessively tight, it works very nicely. Now, there's some major side effects from intrathecal baclofen people have to be aware of and has to be used carefully. It is FDA approved. It's not considered experimental or anything. And it's also been around for 20 years or more. So, people understand well, people in the business, so to speak, have a good idea of how it works and where to apply it and what to watch for. But a person who has an intrathecal baclofen pump has a artificial device, a pump, implanted in their body. So it's very important that person get the pump refilled regularly, which typically is every 3 to 4 months, depending. And it's very important they're caring for the site, not getting infections, not getting skin breakdown. I always tell people that, if someone's unable to cooperate with regular follow-ups, is not able to be reliable that way with, getting in to get their skin checked and getting their pump refilled, they really shouldn't get one put in. because people can go through a very serious syndrome of withdrawal if they don't get their pump refilled, and people have died that way.
Oh my!
If the pump goes dry, people can have seizures as a result. And there have been not many, as far as I know, there have been two cases where people have gone into what's called status or a very severe form of seizure, which has led to their death, sadly.
Jeez.
So, you know, it's a thing to be taken very seriously. You can get skin breakdown, and which can lead to sepsis. And of course, you have to take the pump out at that point, and it's several days in the hospital. You know, it's a big problem. So, intrathecal baclofen is a very useful, specialized treatment, but it has to be in the right hands, the right kind of patient, the right kind of family, and a person with a lot of expertise in how to adjust them and fill them. All that being said, it can be very, very helpful for people. So I've seen a lot of people really benefit from those and do well with them long term.
Sure. It's great that there's options, that can help with some of this too, at least limit it.
There are several good options. Other treatments, more extreme treatments, which we try to avoid but can't always avoid, would be orthopedic type surgeries to release joints or to fuse joints. Someone has treatment-resistant spasticity and they're getting progressively severe joint abnormalities, we always consider, well, maybe we'll just fuse the wrist or fuse the ankle. And that will, if you cut the muscles to the joint and put the joint in a more functional position, then you will help the person's function. But, we reserve that kind of thing for very, very treatment-resistant cases and only as a last resort.
Wow,
that's a permanent change.
Sure, it would be.
So there again, going back to my, one of my general principles that I try to apply is always thinking ahead of, if there's a cure for multiple sclerosis someday, I'd hate for my patients to have a fused ankle joint.
For sure.
That's permanent.
Yeah.
But in some cases, that sort of thing's required.
Gotcha. So right now, spasticity, it will never completely go away. There's no cure.
Correct. The only way to cure spasticity would be to cure the underlying condition.
Gotcha. All right. Yeah. So fingers crossed that someday we'll get that.
Yes.
We've come a long way, I'm sure. Have you seen a little less, patients who are dealing with this at all because of the treatments that are there for MS?
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. No, the treatment for multiple sclerosis has improved remarkably since I was first working with patients in the 1990s. So yeah, I'm seeing many, many more patients whose disease progression is significantly slowed or in many cases stopped by the newer treatments. And
great.
So spasticity becoming therefore less of an issue. So that's been really great to see. So yeah, absolutely. I think that's right.
Great. So if a patient comes to you, thinks that they might have spasticity, besides the clinical background and, the diagnosis and talking about, symptoms, is there any other diagnostic tools that you use?
Sometimes we'll use electromyography, putting a needle in the muscle to seeing if it's overactive, if we're not certain. Many times when we're doing botulinum toxin injections, we'll use electromyography guidance, and that'll help us see which muscles are overactive. You can see the electrical signals generated by muscle overactivity, so that's very helpful to kind of guide which muscles you want to target. Input from family, input from therapists and nurses and other healthcare professionals is always very helpful too. Part of the complication is these tone patterns, the spasticity patterns often vary. So it might be worse at night, or it might be worse when someone's cold, or, I have several patients who do very well during the summer, but in cold weather, they have much more muscle tightness and spasticity. Sometimes a person's chief complaint might be that the spasticity is worse when they're trying to sleep. It's driving them crazy at night. But when I see them during the day, their muscle tone is under relatively good control. Mm. So keeping in mind that these tone patterns vary makes a big difference too.
So what would be some of the most common questions that you get from patients about spasticity?
Why did my spasticity spike up suddenly? And a lot of times that's because of something that's noxious to the body. Very commonly, Anything that is painful or is causing harm to the body will make spasticity worse.
So that could be heat or cold too?
Heat or cold, or a decubitus ulcer or skin breakdown, or very commonly in hospitalized rehabilitation patients, a bladder infection. Urinary tract infection will oftentimes cause spasticity to bounce up. I've had spinal cord patients approach me and say, well, I've got a bladder infection now. And I'll ask them, well, how could you possibly know that? You have no sensation, you know, below the neck and no movement and no awareness of that. And they'll say, well, I can tell because my spasms are kicking up so badly.
Interesting.
This is what always happens when I get, so... Bad constipation, hemorrhoids, you know, sometimes a broken bone. I've had the occasional patients with, you know, very severe disability who don't have any sensation in their foot, but they'll run into with their power wheelchair, bump into something, break a toe, not feel it per se,
sure,
but then their spasms kick up and we're like, well, you know, we should investigate that further. So any patient who comes in and says, boy, what's going on? My spasticity's really cranked up recently. We have to start kind of marching down that list of possibilities of, you know, what's going on that might be painful for your body right now, even if you're not particularly aware of it. That's a common one. You know, of course, what can you do to help me is, you know, to function better is a very common one. People obviously are concerned about side effects long term. I often get the question, you know, can if you start injections, what happens if we stop them? Can these be continued for long term? The answer is they can. You know, we've got there are patients who've been getting botulinum toxin shots for spasticity every 3 months when it wears off. So four times a year for 20 plus years. Okay. You know, as far as we know, there's no lifetime limit or you know, long-term side effects that way. I don't know. What other questions would occur to you, Natalie? Those are common ones I get.
Yeah, probably the same. I guess, do you have anyone who's just frustrated who comes in and who's just kind of at their wit's end, who's just like, you know, why did this happen? And just frustration. I mean, what would you say to those patients?
It's a very difficult thing to help people with at that point, because, you know, typically if a person's to that point, they're at that point not because they started there, they've ended up at that point because their doctors and therapists and nurses haven't been able to help them significantly or to address their chief complaint. And that's a very difficult problem. You know, I certainly don't understand the nature of suffering in this world. And there are some people who, unfortunately, despite our best efforts, you know, we don't get what I would consider adequate control of their spasticity. Or the treatments that relieve their spasticity, you know, unblock their weakness to the point where, you know, we can't find that sweet spot. And we, you know, we struggle to give them some kind of partial relief as best we can. So, yeah, it does happen. You know, I tell people that I consider our success rate about 85% with management of spasticity. And by success, you know, I tend to think of it in terms of sort of a global quality of life scale, which is, are you glad you came in to see us? Are you better now than you were before we gave you this medicine, treatment, injection, whatever, surgery, say? And would you do it again? And so 85% of the time, the patients will say, yes, you know, it was worth it. I would do it again. It was time-consuming, sometimes painful. You know, I don't like getting shots. And it was a headache, and, you know, many times it's expensive, you know, as all healthcare is in our country, unfortunately. But it was worth it. You know, and we can get about 85%. But, you know, but what about that 15%, you
right,
know, who we don't achieve that? And that's very difficult. I mean... for those patients, I kind of fall back on what I consider an inadequate, less than great response, which is, well, you know, we can't help you right now to meet the goals you stated, but let's try as best we can to keep you in as good a shape as possible and prevent complications as much as possible, waiting for better treatments to come down the
sure
road.
Sure, yep.
Because 20 years ago, you know, if you'd asked me, you know, do you think there will be medications where some patients will have a great response to MS and over the course of decades not have significant disease progression, I probably would have guessed no. Mm-hmm. But that's where we're at now. There's been significant improvements. So I can only imagine what improvements there'll be down the road in the next several years. So, you know, for those patients where we're not getting there yet, I say, well, you know, we need to try as best we can to maintain hope and prevent complications and keep their bodies and their minds as good as possible, waiting for the medical science to catch up with them and their problems so that they can get some relief and meet their goals.
Which it has proven to be the case with MS. So hopefully it will continue to be that way. And 85% is pretty good. Okay. All right. Well, anything else that I'm missing about spasticity?
No. I think that was a very thoughtful series of questions. So no, I can't think of anything else. I would just emphasize unfortunately, there's no one size fits all treatment for this, you know? So oftentimes working in a team is very helpful, particularly for our more severely disabled patients, because, for example, a person with spastic quadriplegia affecting all four limbs, for adequate control of their spasticity, you may need the physical therapist to make sure their wheelchair is correctly fitted so they're comfortable in controlling those tone patterns with their seating. You may need medications on board to try to control as much as possible the muscle tightness all through their body. Then they might need injection treatments with botulinum toxin, Botox, or one of the other formulations to control focal spasms, say in their hand or where their knees pull together too much. And they might need an occupational therapist to make them a proper splint that fits well and is comfortable and works well to keep their hand from curling up at night so they don't get joint contractures. And then you need the parents and caregivers or loved ones, spouses, sons, daughters on board doing the range of motion at home when the therapy inevitably stops and there's no more funding for therapy to keep things where they should be. So, you know, you really need sort of a whole team.
You need the village. Absolutely. Yeah, okay. Well, thank you, Dr. Began, so much for your insight on this.
Sure. You're welcome. Anytime.